My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome the 2021 recipient of the Julia Child Award, Tony Tipton Martin. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Tony about what the award means to her, recognizing African-American culinary contributions, and we'll hear Tony's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. It's who Julia was, what she stood for, and what she accomplished, particularly as a role model, that in turn inspired the creation of the Julia Child Award itself. The Foundation's trustees wanted to not only spotlight, but lend further support to those following in Julia's footsteps in the American food world. As lofty as the criteria are, finding someone who embodies all that Julia did as an educator, communicator, innovator, mentor, and bridge builder, while acting with independence, integrity, and public spirit, is a very high bar. Yet each year, the jury manages to select a person whose accomplishments rise above, often even above Julia's. The Julia Child Award was created by the Foundation to shine a light on those still in their prime who are making a profound and significant difference in the way Americans cook, eat, and drink. The recognition comes with a $50,000 grant from the Foundation to enable the recipient to further the work that matters most to them. You also get a beautiful engraved copper pan. This year, the jury selected multi-award-winning food journalist, historian, author, and soon-to-be PBS personality, Tony Tipton Martin, as the seventh recipient. In selecting Tony, the jury recognized her work as a writer, editor, academic, and in particular, food justice warrior. Tony has long championed the study, appreciation, and awareness of African-American food. She's also the first food writer to receive the award. In accepting the honor, Tony said, "I wanted my work to reclaim African-American kitchen wisdom and make our cooking more accessible. It is in this same spirit that I look forward to using the Julia Child Award grant to inspire the next generation of food writers and chefs." Tony is the editor-in-chief of Cook's Country magazine and the author of the award-winning books Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking, and The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. Jubilee was published in 2019 and The Jemima Code in 2015. In 2005, Tony published a historic reprint of an early 20th century work, The Bluegrass Cookbook by Minnie C. Fox, containing the first known photographs of African-American cooks. The first African-American food editor at a major American newspaper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Tony was twice invited to the White House by former First Lady Michelle Obama for her work helping families live healthier lives. Tony was honored by the Southern Foodways Alliance with the John Egerton Prize in 2014. She's appeared as a guest judge on Bravo's Top Chef, was featured on CBS Sunday Morning's annual food show, and in Netflix's High on the Hog series. She's been a featured speaker at the Library of Congress, many universities, and published in Best Food Writing of 2016. Tony is also the very first guest we've ever had on the podcast twice. If you'd like to hear our conversation with Tony about Jubilee, check out episode 69. She joins us today to talk about receiving the 2021 Julia Child Award and also about what she's working on now. Welcome back to the podcast, Toni.
Thank you so much for having me, Todd, and thanks for that wonderful intro.
My pleasure. I thought it was important that everyone know how many things you have going on and tackle and have accomplished. And that feeds right into, you know, given all these things that you've been working very hard on and that are, you know, very near and dear to your heart. What does it mean to you to receive the Julia Child Award?
Oh, this is probably one of the most important moments of my career. This degree of acknowledgement for my personal efforts is really very special. Most people know me for my advocacy for African American cooks and primarily for authors of cookbooks. And I very, very seldom talk about myself or how the various strands of my activities are connected to one another. I've just appear to be really busy and have a very full career. But what I really love is that this award acknowledges the way that all of the pieces of my work, all of my ambitions have really become visible. There's an awareness now that everything I've been doing, I've done it with intentionality and purpose. These were not just arbitrary choices to elevate the next generation. And that's what Julia did. And so, of course, to receive an award in her name is it's just really a gift.
Well, I love hearing that because that is absolutely the foundation's intention is really, and I don't think we've talked to that, about that with another recipient, that it is very true that it's much about the person and what not just what they've accomplished, but as you say, their intention and how that flows from Julia's example to the present day. So I love that you pointed that out and that you feel that.
Yeah. As a journalist, I have been primarily focused on the work of others to inspire more tolerance, more appreciation for food, an expanded view of what it means to cook African-American dishes. And Julia really set out to do those same things. So if there's anything that wasn't intentional initially, I guess it was in my realizing that in my love of watching her, I was actually being quietly mentored by her in a very private, intimate way.
That's lovely too. I was going to say that it's interesting too. I think that you come from maybe as a starting place, this journalistic background. And I think we've talked before that you even started with maybe I don't know if resistance is the right word, but an apprehension about being a food writer or food journalist versus a, you know, straightforward news journalist, because that was somehow not what you were brought up to pursue.
Yeah, you know, this whole idea of my calling, my first book, The Jemima Code, is rooted in the dual identity and representation of African-American cooks in this country. The broader community has had a love-hate relationship with Black cooks. And as a result of that, we as a culture have struggled with this dual identity that says we are at once very competent and our cooking can be viewed as expressions of incredible hospitality and quality. But at the same time, we've been disparaged and demoralized and our images degraded in the public sphere. And so this confused identity, I think, continues to persist, but certainly in my generation and those generations in my recent past, we struggled with whether to enter this field at all. I think that's happening a lot less so today. And if it is, it's for other types of concerns like you know, finances and being paid one's worth. But for us, it was more about this message of what it meant to be involved in the food world and to be cooking for others and teaching other people to cook. It's a very complicated, difficult story to tell. And so I didn't grow up with this passion for telling food stories. I didn't run to food cooking shows, although, you know, After School, Julia or Graham Care, you know, there were folks on TV in my youth, but it wasn't really an aspiration for me until my college years.
Yeah, and I think if you'll permit me, I'll spell it out a little bit more for audiences that may not be as up to speed, is that certainly in terms of African-American assimilation into mainstream society or being equal, the idea of choosing a career that had a deep association with service and service to others was, you know, had a certain incongruous feeling. You were going backward rather than forward. And that's, it changed a lot. I think ironically, I was thinking that this sort of putting chefs on a pedestal, which really happened after Julia was on the scene, and making them celebrities in some ways gave people of all walks of life more permission to pursue that cooking career because it was given more loft and legitimacy.
Yes, of course it was, but the duality of the work continued to persist even then, even within that structure of elevating chefs and creating celebrity, because African Americans were seldom considered in that role. As you helped me point out, thank you. African Americans have always been viewed through history, through literature, through television and film as the servants, those who were taking instruction from their white mistresses or from their employers as when they were serving as domestics, but never the creators, not the people that were the knowledge holders. We were thought to be the people just following instructions mindlessly. And we as a community knew that couldn't be further from the truth. And I think the reality is the people on the ground knew that that was not true. But that was the way that we elevated one group above another to say that, yes, history has said, yes, these African-American cooks did perform really well and contributed to our view of hospitality, but it's tragic that they did so without being particularly smart about it or having the technical knowledge that we associate with being classically trained. And so then that's what rolls into the modern day and celebrity chefs, because if African Americans have not been attending culinary academy or elevated within restaurant structures to serve as executive chef, then we're still lingering in the lower labor force associated with the preparation of food.
Which is quite extraordinary, because I was just thinking about the first Julia Child Award recipient, Jacques Pepin, who he might have gone to a culinary school, but he really learned to cook at the side of his mother and his aunt, who ran restaurants in I believe it was Lyon. And that was the way that many of the people, particularly historically African-American cooks, were taught. They were taught by an older person, whether a relative or a mentor, which is a completely equally legitimate way to learn, particularly to cook, you know, dishes that are very personal or unique rather than just, you know, how to run a giant catering kitchen.
Yeah, I think that is all true. And history obviously is recorded in ways that benefit the recorder. And so you could just eliminate that level of discussion and not mention that professional trained chefs also start with that as their inspiration and point of origin, or whatever other variables are left out of the story when it comes to African-American participation. And that's what I love so much about Julia's story as I began to understand it better. It's inspirational to me to know that she was an ordinary, if we can use that word without it being disparaging, but she was a simple housewife. And she was educating herself in French cuisine and improved, developed even more methodologies and techniques until she became the expert who then transitioned all of that knowledge to other ordinary women, primarily in America. And that's what my ancestors were doing with their cookbooks and their recipe styles. They just weren't being given credit for it.
And for those who don't know, that's one of the things that you really outline in the Jemima Code, was also breaking those myths and giving recognition to a very long history of those contributions and the deep legitimacy of those contributions and the deep under-recognition of them. I wanted to ask you, since the award very much, as you said, it recognizes your intention and your whole career and your whole person, but one of the things that is significant and unique about your contributions are how you've been a driving force and adding to the American cultural understanding by amplifying African-American culinary history. But certainly, I think it's striking to me that since 2019, when Jubilee came out and had a wonderful reception, so much has transpired in terms of racial justice and social justice and equity since 2019, from the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests. I was curious if that's changed your view of your findings, or it's really just reinforced where you were like, yeah, that's what I was freaking saying. You've probably been too busy to look back, but I was just curious how you feel looking from 2019, which was so recent, but yet so long ago.
Well, I would love to go back to 2015 and I would say, yeah, that's freaking how I feel about it. It's so, you know, when I conceived of the idea of the Jemima Code, it was viewed as a multi-part project with where we are today as the end state. And that is the liberation of African Americans of all kind from this narrow representation of the mammy cook or the slave cook or the servant cook. And to give the broader rest of the community freedom to appreciate our craft and our creative in whatever way we deem as creative and representative of our people. African Americans have been largely pigeonholed into this idea that all of our cooking descends from the slave cabin. And there is some incredible intelligence associated with the idea that one could make healthy, sustainable, delicious food from the leavings of a main kitchen. Be very careful with those words there, and not dwell on this idea that we're limiting this conversation to the plantation South, right? That the notion is that African Americans were really good at handling garbage and masters' leftovers and leavings from the kitchen, Well, and that story continued to persist all the way through the 60s and the notion of soul food, which is the food that the migrants who left the South and moved into more northern cities for job opportunities in industry took those same kinds of foods with them. And there is certainly respect for the soul food canon and what was accomplished there. But as I alluded to earlier, there is a second message associated with African-American cooking. And it is when we recognize and acknowledge that second lane of Black food that we are all set free. And so, yes, today's interest in talking to people of all races and providing more voices in publications and on media platforms, the interest in publishing more Black books, Black or books by BIPOC authors, not just African Americans here, but the fact that there's just so much more interest in individuals as representatives of community is certainly, I think, tied to the fact that those two books, Jemima Code and Jubilee, set us free from the narrowly defined boundaries that kept us within soul food and servitude.
Yeah, I'm struck by what you said, that there was a certain implication that there was also stasis, that like those things happened and then it just stood still, which is, of course, not at all what happened. And in that, in many places, as particularly African Americans and descendants of slaves migrated north and west, they continued cooking and they continued opening restaurants and they continued developing dishes through their own skills and knowledge, independent of others telling them. And that, I think those stories are only beginning to be told in terms of like due credit. And, you know, people maybe can name Leah Chase and Dookie Chases from New Orleans. But beyond that, she obviously had many, many cohorts who are not well known, but should be.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have to remember that African Americans were not immigrants to this country, but we did do the best we could to survive in an immigrant fashion. And that is to say that when people migrate from another country, they bring their cultural ways with them. And this crazy history that we've believed in all of these years expects us to believe that Africans who left West Africa did not bring any traditions with them, culinary or cultural. Now, there was a system in place that did its best to erase those and to ensure that we certainly did not display those publicly without threat to our lives. And so, of course, many of those techniques go underground. They're embedded in other dishes. They're embedded in the ways that we treat similar foods when we find them in our native and natural environments here in America. So it isn't just that we don't speak about the recipes that were created when people migrated and there wasn't anyone instructing them. What we also don't talk about is what kinds of knowledge our ancestors brought with them in their souls and embedded in the American food system. We're just now beginning to tease that out.
Yeah, and certainly people with maybe proper scholarship of slavery and how plantations were run have understood or learned that this knowledge that you're talking about, that African slaves who were forcibly brought to the States brought with them and actually contributed to actually helping the other settlers who were free survive. And it was often their skills and knowledge of survival that helped the wider population survive. They just had no choice in whether they made their contribution or not.
Yeah, and I think there's a zealousness on the part of everyone today that does concern me, Rooting out these stories has been very difficult to do because the information is embedded in so many sources. It requires investigative skills. It involves scholarly research techniques. And basically you're on a treasure hunt looking through various sources because those early scholars were not recording food traditions and food behaviors. Food was not really considered a topic that they were recording as much. So we learn about other kinds of skills when we read historical representation of the Atlantic slave trade, but we don't often hear about cooking and food as often as we should. And so what that's doing is creating a little bit of room for people to theorize and to ask the questions like, how did that rice get into South Carolina that the Africans were so proficient in using? And I just think we have to be really careful that we don't further mythologize a community that's already had enough trouble trying to find some stability in the food system by presuming that people did things like braid okra or rice seeds in their hair on their way to the slave ship. Like, I just think we have to, you know, we need some citations for that. We need to be careful that in our desire to respect, to appreciate, to honor, and acknowledge contributions, that we are doing so in a very factual way. And so again, that ties me back to what, you know, the inspiration I took from Julia, because that's exactly what she did with mastering. It wasn't just enough to teach cooking, you know, classes to women. She wanted to record it.
Well, we are going to come right back and we're going to pick that up, because I think it relates to what I want to ask you next about your plans for the grant and how that kind of carries this forward into the future. So we'll be right back with more from this year's Julia Child Award recipient, food justice warrior and writer, Toni Tipton Martin. Stay with us.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're talking to the 2021 recipient of the Julia Child Award, culinary historian, journalist, cookbook author, soon-to-be PBS personality, and food justice warrior, Toni Tipton Martin. So, Toni, before the break, we were just talking about the intention and specifically how you go on a treasure hunt to unlock what you can about the truth and to also change prevailing historical narratives that were biased or misinformed or deliberately misleading. And I thought that kind of ties in nicely to what you plan to do with the $50,000 grant that comes with the award. So can you tell us about your plans, or at least where your plans are at this point?
So my plans are that we are reorienting the 501c3 nonprofit that I founded in 2008 as an outreach to underserved families. We're going to reorient that toward young women. Well, let me just say to emerging women writers. We aren't entirely sure that they will all be young.
There's not going to be an age restriction, but you're thinking of the emerging at whatever age they are.
Well, you know, when you say next generation, there's the implication that you mean young. But this award is coming to me at a time when I'm still feeling pretty young career-wise. So I really want to be conscious of that. I've been around the industry a really long time, but I took a break in order to raise my family. And I'm grateful that I was able to come back and come back this strong. So I don't want to put limitations on who it is that we might be able to inspire. But what I've done is, as a beginning, once I received word that I was a recipient of this amazing award, I gathered some of my friends who are among the top female thought leaders in the food world, and asked them if they would sit on an advisory committee. And this is a diverse group of women. Intentionally chosen, frankly, because of their approaches to food and culture, their defense of their own personal culture. So we have Latina, we have Appalachian, we have Indian, we have African American, and women. We have binders of women. And we are looking at ways that we can turn my nonprofit, which has always used the idea of role models inspiring the next generation, to cultivating conversations between women in the video space, similar to what would have been a seminar or weekend conference or symposia. But we're going to actually pay women their worth. We're going to pay the speakers. We are going to make sure that the services are accessible so that you don't have to pay membership fees. We're going to try and tackle as many of the barriers to entry to these types of masterclass sessions as we can. And then what we want to do with those sessions is provide tips, hints, tell our struggles, tell our stories, but help the next generation of writers understand what has been accomplished, what struggles we had, so that they can carry whatever parts of those tools into their toolbox and be successful in the food media world as it currently exists. So we're aware that we've accomplished and overcome some systems that don't necessarily exist anymore, but some of them still do. So we want to help people learn things like how to write a cookbook proposal and what you should be looking for in that cookbook contract. It's not just enough to get a big fat advance, because you have to understand all of the ways that that is gobbled up and or what it means to actually earn out that project. So we're going to be looking
or how long they take.
And how long that might take.
Even when it sounds like a big number, if it takes you 4 years, it's suddenly a much smaller number.
We've got people on this group who have not ever earned theirs out, and they're top sellers. So those are important conversations to have. We want to talk about recipe development and its expression, the way that it's been used to create barriers to entry for some folks. As we were talking about earlier, if you don't have an understanding of the scientific method, then perhaps your recipes are considered weak and you aren't able to really deliver. But maybe it's just a matter of translating those recipes and skills that you have from one language into another. So we have put together, right now we've got about a dozen video themes, and we've got some women in mind to deliver them. We're really excited about that, and we're thinking that sometime in the late spring we'll be able to announce a sort of online women's writing symposium.
Well, of course, we at the foundation love this, and I just thought this is going to sound like, well, of course we're excited about it because, you know, we talked to you, except that the way the grant with the award works is the only criteria that the foundation puts to the recipient for the grant is it has to be used in a food world nonprofit context. And it needs to be connected to their passions. But of course, we at the foundation have been looking for the last decade for, maybe this isn't the best word, but for lack of a better word, replacement solutions to what used to be the journalistic training for food writers that existed, that with the changes in the publishing world and the digital world, a lot of those opportunities to learn technique, understanding, or to be mentored have really vanished, if not been significantly reduced. So I think that's a fantastic and very affirming approach to some of the foundation's missions. So we are really looking forward to seeing how that rolls out.
Well, and anyone who might think that I contrived this idea afterwards, I think it's important for people to know that my nonprofit was set up as a mentoring and training program. And at the time, the social need was to educate and empower families of color that were being marginalized and disenfranchised in terms of food insecurity and health disparities. And that was an important philosophy that we carried on for those first few years. And socially, things have changed so much and so fast that what's been good is that I've been distracted with my own work and the nonprofit sat dormant for a short period. But during that time, I was still meeting with this group of friends, asking how we could make an impact using this business. So before there even was a Julia, the graciousness of a Julia Award, we were already in discussion, especially having been leaders who were part of the founding of Southern Foodways Alliance and the Appalachian Food Summit and Foodways Texas. My partner in this, Ronnie Lundy, and I had been at this idea for many, many years, not seeing women represented in the standard organization gatherings and delivery of content and programming. We just couldn't figure out how to do it. And without forcing people with fewer resources to try to come into a town, book hotels and flights and pay for registration fees, like that whole model was an obstacle for us to execute. And so between the Julia Award and frankly, the pandemic and this move to video and Zoom, we've been able to master an idea that we've been, you know, just mulling over and wishing there was a new solution, and the solution just dropped right into our laps. It's been really wonderful.
I know. I was just thinking, it's just like when a good roux comes together, finally, right?
It's exactly like that. Keep stirring, and you have to be patient over very low heat so that it doesn't scorch. And certainly over time, we have tried our own other alternative ideas. And these are, as I said, thought leaders who are authoritative and knowledgeable in their own lanes, but they've put down their egos, as we did at Southern Foodways Alliance 20 years ago, and see the greater need here to empower more women to pursue the stories that I have pursued that have unlocked the freedom that we've been talking about for the broader industry.
Well, I think that's so encouraging and exciting to see what comes out of it. So I want to talk about this new role that is also very, not brand new, but recent, especially since 2019, now that you're the editor-in-chief at Cook's Country, which for those who maybe don't know it that well, is part of the America's Test Kitchen family. And America's Test Kitchen is possibly maybe best known for publishing Cook's Illustrated, the companion magazine to Cook's Country. But I wanted to ask you, because in some ways, at least to me, and it may be my own ignorance, I think of Cook's Country as this very mainstream heartland kind of publication. And so I wanted to ask you, like, does this represent a new chapter and a new page in your career? Or how do you see it intersecting with the work that the award is recognizing that we've been talking about?
Well, I love that question. And yes, Heartland is a really accurate description. There are others that think about it in terms of more of the word, you know, the perception of the word country as rural, more homespun, but certainly not that high intellectual scientific cooking and high methodology and technique representation that happens at Cook's Illustrated. And so what's really fun to me about the title Cook's Country is that we've been actually able to spin those words with a new definition. I don't have to change the title of the magazine. I only have to reorient them to focus on the cooks of the country. And in that way, my vision for the magazine is to always focus on the people behind the recipes that we love as Americans. What are our favorites and who cooks them? Recipes don't make themselves. There's always a person who's been there cooking your favorite brownies, your birthday cake, your favorite dinner. And we often, at least in the past, the people behind the stories weren't the main focus in our pages. There was a lot more emphasis on technique and method. And the fact that the staff was adapting recipes through their vision after testing 3 or 4 or 5 different versions. And what we're going to do now is be more transparent about our sources. We're going to be looking for very specific sources to help us refine our knowledge about a particular area. For example, in our October-November issue, we have a story, our cover story is on smoking your holiday Thanksgiving turkey. And most people would not think of that as a traditional approach. And they certainly would not see the story behind it tied to pitmaster Rodney Scott as a Cook's Country story, right? We would tend to think more in terms of the standard, beautiful, golden, brown, centerpiece, roasted bird. But this dish is amazing. It's delicious. We've got a technique that is unique to Cook's Country, which is cooking on a grill with this charcoal snake. So there is some brilliance to it. And there's also a person behind the story who is our inspiration. And our staff person still gets to be an essential part of the story as well. So it's my approach to Cook's Country is the same as my approach to the focus on African Americans. It is just now, just the fact that now I will be expanding that equity to all American cooks, all of us as creators and innovators with great stories to tell about our dishes.
Yeah, I feel like that breaks down to you're going to give credit where credit is due and recognize that food doesn't cook itself.
Those are the two philosophies that I started out with the team. And I've gradually learned to say it in many different ways. Sourcing. We're doing a lot of really fun things, too. Anyone who's been a reader or a subscriber is already in love with some of the personalities that we have. But we want to amplify the personalities on staff as well. So I'm going to be doing a lot more to grow the team and to grow their identities and their visibility and help draw out of them what their areas of interest are so that consumers can start to follow people that they love for a particular kind of story that they get accustomed to them telling. The thought that comes to mind is we have an amazing feature on our pages called On the Road. And it is crafted by our executive food editor, Brian Roof. And in some ways, it's just an expression of traditional journalism in a place where that type of sourcing didn't happen before, meaning that he goes out on the road to various parts of the country and comes back with a great recipe. It might be butter burgers from Wisconsin. It could be slug burgers. You know, it could be Jamaican rice and peas, right? But he's going out and finding these stories and then allowing the creators to tell us more about their technique and what is unique about what it is that they do. And we're going to also integrate that onto the TV show. More.
Well, that was my next question, because I wanted to hear, I've said that you're soon to be a PBS personality, which I hope is an okay way of saying it, because I don't think the first shows with you featuring in them have launched. But can you just tell us about the show and what new role that you're going to play?
So the new shows have launched. They launched, I think, in September, October. We have a new segment that we have added to the recipe development and cooking segments. And it's called In the Library. And in some ways it is patterned after In the Kitchen with Julia and the Master Chefs series that she did. We're in my library, in my home, where my cookbooks live. And I use my cookbooks as a jump off point to talk about one aspect of a recipe that we're featuring on the show. And so this will be where you learn the history behind a particular dish. Previously, they would certainly mention very quickly that Eugene Gagliardi was the creator of popcorn chicken. And then they would swiftly move into the recipe development and start talking about the type of part of the meat that was chosen or the breading that was preferred and the seasoning and so on. But what we will be doing here is moving more of that conversation about the recipe, its origins, its history, any fun facts that we can share. Those will all take place in my library, and I will be the one to deliver those.
And so is that segment in every episode, or how often does it come up in the series?
It's in every episode so far.
How great. And where can people watch it?
You can watch on your local public television station. Cook's Country TV and America's Test Kitchen TV run back to back on Saturday afternoons, and you can check your local listings and find us there.
All right, well, we'll check it out. And after the break, we're going to hear Tony's second Julia moment. Get in touch, send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @JuliaChildJCF and let us know what you think about today's show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mess like this. No, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
I know, it's so good.
She's so good.
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. We've already talked a lot about that. You've given us a Julia moment before, so we're really putting the screws to you, Tony, to asking you for a second official Julia moment. Go for it.
Well, I can tell you that there's no screws because I have several.
Okay.
As I said earlier, I didn't grow up initially studying Julia, but once I found her, I actually did study her ways. And we heard the kinds of things that she would say to encourage people to develop their courage. And one of the quotes that I really loved was the way that she taught without being overbearing. In one case, she was focusing on the importance of making diced vegetables. She wanted them to be pretty, and she wanted them to be precise and uniform. And so in her instruction to us as cooks, she said that when we trimmed the ends of the vegetables away, we shouldn't worry about those being discarded. Those were for the cook. And for the rest of my career and to this day, every time I chop a bell pepper or celery or any fresh vegetable that I'm trimming, I always nibble those ends. And I think about her in the way that one might hold a toast to honor someone's memory. It's those trims, those vegetable ends that are trimmed that she talked about in teaching us how to be better cooks.
Oh, I love that. I've never heard that before. That's a great one. You've definitely now provided a second exemplary and memorable Julia moment. Thank you very much, Tony.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. It's been great to have you back, and great to go through this journey for being the seventh recipient of the Julia Child Award with you.
I'm so honored by the award, but also by your invitation, inviting me to come back. And I thank you so, so much for this acknowledgement of my work and support.
Our sincere pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. To keep up with Tony, it's @TonyTiptonMartin on Facebook and Instagram, and @TheJemimaCode on Twitter. For more on her work, books, and her plans for the Julia Child Award grant program, you can check out TonyTiptonMartin.com. And for more from America's Test Kitchen, it's @America's Test Kitchen and @Cook's Country on Facebook, @Cook's Country and @Test Kitchen on Instagram and Twitter. If you want to learn more about the Julia Child Award itself and its past recipients, go to juliachildaward.com. And to watch the presentation of this year's Julia Child Award to Tony Tipton Martin at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History on November 4th, make sure you're following the foundation. We'll post when it's ready to watch. It's @Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. You'll also want to keep an eye out to register for the museum's virtual program featuring Tony in conversation with Alilia Bundles, Padma Lakshmi, and Sandra Gutierrez on November 12th. The Julia Child Award clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH, thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after, wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.